started this meeting with the age-old question. You know, there's some questions in the world that you can't answer, right? Like, why is the sky blue? I don't know. Why does the moon revolve around the earth? You know, those kinds of questions. So I asked myself, why does the sun keep on shining? You know, you're with me. Everybody's with me, right? But there's one that we have to add to this thing. You know, this is Parliament. This isn't like we don't run the Formula One or we don't run hospitals. Nothing exciting ever happens in Parliament, right? But yet we get decaf coffee. I mean, who needs decaf? How do we stay awake, really? I think it's a deliberate ploy. So, Mr. Brown, please, who needs decaf, eh? Next time we order coffee, tell them extra caffeine, nothing. Okay. Good morning to everybody, including our guests. Maybe ISP should get off the phone. Let's switch off the phone, madame. You need it. Yeah. Bring it back. But everybody. Huh? Okay. Welcome to the people from SAFE. Just a few housekeeping things. And just to say that there's a clash with higher education today. Now, that shouldn't happen in the sense that we've been allocated a Tuesday morning and higher education has been given a Wednesday morning. And if there is a Tuesday intersection or a Wednesday intersection with either higher or basic, then one would assume that the committee whose allocated time it is has preference. In other words, if it's a Tuesday morning where there's a clash, then members are expected to be at basic regardless, those who are members of basic. And likewise, when there is a clash on a Wednesday, and assuming basic has got some things to do on a Wednesday, then those members who are members of higher should expect to prioritize higher because that is their slot, okay? It's something that I raised with the WIP, who is also not here, which I think is going to cause enormous problems. thank you. So that's the one thing. The second thing that I wanted to just talk to was the issue of our workshop last week. Now, it's been raised with me that there was some concern because not every member was able to go on that trip to Pretoria. And there is a long, very sad story, so boring that if you haven't got caffeinated coffee, you might fall asleep. But the long and short of it all was that we were not given permission for all of us to go. And the house chairperson wasn't available for us to go and appeal his initial decision. He was overseas, so it was very difficult to communicate with him once that decision was made. But having said that, also, we got notice. Our application to the house chairperson did go very late because we got notice of the workshop, despite Mr. Brown constantly reminding the department, and I don't know where the parliamentary liaison officer has gone, but we constantly reminded Ms. Chebeka, who you remember was here, and who raised with us the possibility of the workshop with the district subject advisors, and we had committed that we felt it was important that we be present at that workshop. But literally we got notification of the workshop going ahead at the 11th hour. We got notification on the Thursday. On Friday, we had to do all of the administration in terms of approving the application to spend the money and to do the accommodation and so on. And it was really a nightmare. And given that the chairperson was overseas and uncontactable, it was really quite a problem. And actually, Mr. Brown, I must thank you for your efforts. Mr. Brown works on full throttle most of the day, which allows me to relax a little part of the day. So I'm terribly sorry for those of you who were not there, and we will produce a proper report to the committee on the engagement. But really and truly, if I may just say, and others will have an opportunity to just add those, Dr. Kloppers-Lawrence, you were there, and Ms. Mashishi was there, and Ms. Nda was there from COPE. Basically, I think the most important thing wasn't what the workshop dealt with, but that we were able to engage those delegates from the side of the Portfolio Committee to speak to them about how very important it is that the education system needs to be prioritized, that they themselves in their day-to-day dealings with teachers who are teaching in our classrooms and so on, that they need to be, you know, enormously professional, that they need to interact with them to the best of their ability, and that really the future of education is very squarely in their hands. We're also able to engage with individual content advisors at the district level over lunch, and that was quite an eye-opening experience, certainly for me. And I've come to recognize that the priorities in education, or certainly the biggest priority for me, is the issue that SACE is very centrally seized with, and that is teacher development and qualification and training. And certainly from our side, it's the area that we hope to engage with you with very, very keenly and closely. I see we have a new member as well. Do you want to just introduce yourself, ma'am? Oh, Ms. Nkulisi, we haven't seen you in a while. You're our alternate, are you? And which other committee do you serve in? Okay, and that meets most of the time, does it?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, just note for your edification that our slot is Tuesday morning. So if ever you're available on a Tuesday morning, we will be sitting. There should be a program that would have gone to you, which is a continuous agenda program. But you'll note that the slot is a Tuesday morning and you have the venues on that program. While you may not have the particular issue that that we're dealing with because it's a continuous agenda, but I'm sure Mr. Brown sends you those updates as well. Have you been receiving those? Excellent. Thank you very much. I don't know if members want to, those of you who were present at the workshop, want to briefly just make any comments other than the ones that I've made, bearing in mind that we will produce the report as well. Ms. Mashishi? Sure.
Thank you, Chairperson. I think it was a very good engagement with those curriculum advisors. And then what I've realized in some of them, they were saying that the document that the department was talking about, some of them, they didn't receive it. They didn't know whether the schools have received it or not. But it was a very good engagement, Chairperson. Thank you very much.
Can you hear me now? Please. I've got my notes here, but I want to just
perhaps two or three things. The fact that these attendants were very positive about education, and I was very inspired by the fact that they are really geared to make a success of especially early childhood development and grade R. I attended the workshop on grade R after the lunch, and I was surprised to hear about all the problems. But as I said, they are very enthusiastic to deal with those problems. Another thing that was also raised is the problem with mother tongue. I was surprised to hear that we have 8 dialects in Tswana, for instance, which creates a lot of problems, and I don't think all of us realize the problems. Also, they stressed the fact that there was no synchronization between the National Department and many schools. And another thing that was also raised is the fact that the rural schools have many problems, and we should also attend to those problems in due course. Thank you.
Listening is always good. The one thing that Mr. Brown has just reminded me to just tell you would have noticed that our agenda today has been changed. We were supposed to deal with both states as well as the ELRC people. There were two problems with ELRC. We got their presentation only on Thursday afternoon last week. When I had specifically requested that everybody presenting the annual report will submit their presentations 2 weeks before they're attending here. Now, I don't think SAFE did that, but I know that we got yours well before ELRC. But when I got their presentation, it was rather bulky. And I realized at that point that we were, in fact, I only received it on Friday, if you recall. Yeah? Friday morning it went out. So you would have seen in the presentations that we got from ELRC that Mr. Brown would have sent out on Friday morning is rather bulky. And I thought it would be impossible for us to then deal with the two SAFEs as well as them in the one morning that we had today. So we've agreed with the ELRC people that they will come next week and deal with their annual report next week. So that's why the change in the program. Okay. Let's then proceed to the SAFE presentation. I take it members have received it a while ago. Yes? Thank you very much. The people from SAFE, I'm not sure. I think what they've done here is they've chosen the people with the most difficult names. Both of you have very difficult names to pronounce. It's Ms. Caraceta. Seresta. Is that how you say it? Seresta. Okay. I'll spell it with an S and then. And Mr. Bijraj. Mr. Bijraj, thank you very much for that. So, Ms. Seresta, do you want to just present your delegation to us? And then at which point we will ask you thereafter to proceed with your presentation.
Thank you. I'm the outgoing chair, and Mr. Bridgeright is now the acting chair, so he will perform that function.
Thanks, Cynthia. Good morning, Chair and honorable members. Let me introduce the delegation to the House. Seresto is the present Deputy Chair of Council. As she said, she was the past Chair of Council for the last 4-year period. We have appointed a new council a month and a bit ago, and we are in the process of appointing the new chair. The SAFE Act then stipulates that the CEO acts as chair for that interim period. So it's one of those periods that I have a dual honor. Then we have here Mr. Mapindani. He is the Chief Financial Officer. Up front, we have Mr. Njlovu, Mr. Temba Njlovu. He is our Manager for Advocacy, acts very much as our Chief Information Officer. We are missing here Ms. DiPaolo, Ms. C.D. DiPaolo. She's stuck in traffic. She will be joining us as well. And she is the chief operating officer when she comes. So we have C.D., Anthea, myself, Reg, Morris, and Temba. And we don't mind the first names. Chair, first of all, let us, on behalf of the council, which represents the whole teaching profession, the 500,000 of teachers, congratulate the House members for being appointed in this next term of work for our exciting country, and to look forward to your leadership and guidance and support for the work that we try to do as SAFE. In a nutshell, what we try to do as SAFE is to transform the teaching profession to make it more relevant to cater for the new South Africa, to develop our citizens in the way that we want society to develop. So that in a nutshell is what we are doing, and we look forward to your continued support. We've had good support in the past from the Ministry, the Department of Education. I have a feeling that we will get more accelerated support now. There seems to be a kind of a reawakening of enthusiasm in our country for transformation. Chair, let me just indicate how we will go about this presentation. I will make some introductory remarks, general introductory remarks, just to orientate the House, largely based on page 5 of the annual report. Then I will ask the Deputy Chairperson, Mr. Resto, to also make some introductory remarks. There are just one or two areas that she would like to sort of bring to the attention of the House. And then Mr. Ndlovu will actually take us through the nitty-gritty of our strategic plan. That will be the slide presentation as to what we're supposed to do, where we've succeeded, and where there are challenges. And then lastly, we'll have Mr. Mapindani, who will take us through the financial aspects, and I've asked him in particular to hone in on our weaknesses and the audit observations, which he will do. So that is the way in which we'll present, and later we will take questions, and Ms. DiPaolo will assist us in responding to some of the questions when she gets here. Chair, first of all, just for the sake of us all being on the same page, SAFE is governed by the SAFE Act number 31 of 2000. That is where we draw our mandate from. And that Act of 2000 tells us, although SAFE was in operation before that, for many years we were trying to get our documentation and our procedures and guidelines in order. But in the year 2000, it was legislated that SAFE is now an independent statutory body to see to this transformation of the teaching profession by doing three things, Chair. One is to register all educators. Educators go a little beyond teachers, and it is compulsory for all educators to be registered with SAFE. It's actually unlawful for educators to be teaching without being registered. There are still some teachers, our estimation is about 20,000, 30,000 teachers still out there who are not registered who are teaching. And we are trying to correct that together with the Department of Education. Fortunately, the DG has agreed that they want to make this a priority to send out notices to see to which schools are still having teachers who are not registered. Many of these schools don't even know that they have to register. Sometimes they see a deduction in the salaries for the DBs, and they think that they are registered. Then, Chair, we register these teachers according to minimum criteria and standards that are set up with in the council. Of course, they are in line with the department's minimum employment requirements. So there is a kind of connection there. So far, we have registered over 500,000 educators. A number of them are not teaching. A number of them are passed on. And of that lot, we have about 360,000 that are actually practicing. That database is still not a very refined database, but we are trying to validate it and refine it as our resources are now growing. The second mandate, Chair, is the question of professional development, and I am pleased to hear that you as well are excited about the ongoing professional development of our teachers. There we have been doing good work now that the ministry, the department has given us a mandate to manage continuing professional teacher development, and you will hear about our progress there. And it's quite an exciting thing, and fortunately we have the Department of Education giving us support in setting up the infrastructure and watching over the continued growth of teachers. Of course, now in this times of recession, there is a bit of difficulty in terms of getting the funding smoothened out, but we've had a meeting with the minister, and it seems we have found a way out of that as well, and the minister has agreed that she will have a special meeting with SAICE to discuss the model, the optimum model to fund teacher development. There is a lot of money we submitted to the Minister for Teacher Development that is not being adequately utilized. It is our view, and we did submit this to the Minister, that many of the provinces are not doing justice to the teacher development money that is allocated to them. Because of the fact that there seems to be a lot of leeway as to what can be done with that money. The minister has agreed that we need to have a special session to make sure that money that is targeted for teacher development actually goes for teacher development in some managed way. So that I think is good news for us, because there seems to be sufficient money for teacher development, but it's just a question of the methodology for utilization of that money that it seems to be wanting. Then the third part of our work, Chair, is the one that we get the most publicity for, is the ethics, promoting the code of ethics and calling to order teachers who have violated the code of ethics and have brought the profession into disrepute. You know, I must declare to this House that over the last 5 or 6 years when we've had jurisdiction, legal jurisdiction, we had less than 2,000 official complaints. And we had about 350 hearings, which resulted in about less than 100 teachers being struck off the roll. I mean, that is the worst sanction that we mete out to educators. And if we add that to the number of teachers that maybe departments also dismiss, and the departments sometimes do not give us the information, that number could double or triple. And it's a point well worth noting, Chair, because the media sometimes tarnishes the whole profession as containing bad teachers. And this is not the case. Our statistics show us that there are a handful of teachers, less than 0.001%, who have brought the profession into disrepute. We are not saying that there isn't a problem, because even those teachers ought not to be in the profession, and there is more to be done. But sometimes we get an exaggerated negative impression of the teaching profession, which I think all of us need to correct. We need, whenever it's opportune for us to thank and compliment and appreciate our teachers who work under very difficult circumstances in most of the cases. We've raised with the minister, and she is looking into the matter of actually dedicating October 5. As a full day, a special day that is dedicated to recognizing the importance of the work that our teachers do. It's a point that sometimes we miss while we are trying to chase after the few rotten apples. Lastly, Chair, in the way of introduction, we are engaging with the minister in terms of updating the legislation that pertains to SAICE. space has now matured where it works in a kind of cooperative, complementary way with the department and the teacher unions. So it kind of has moved along from being fiercely independent in its early days to be more sort of working in a kind of a partnership way together. And the minister has agreed that she would look into adjusting legislation. So I'm sure at some point the House will have to consider some proposals coming for legislative amendments. For example, you find there is a duplication. The department disciplines teachers, SACE disciplines teachers, teachers go to the courts. So those things kind of need to be streamlined and you know, a proper sort of sharing of these responsibilities. It's not a problem, but I'm saying that it could be refined. So, Chair, that is the little sort of introduction that I wanted to make. And before I forget, we need really to thank the Ministry, the Departments of Education, the teacher unions. I must say, we enjoy good support from all of the stakeholders and the role players in the business that we do. Thank you. I will just hand over to Anthea quickly to make a few more introductory comments before Temba gets into the statistics and the actual details.
Before you do that, let me just get some clarity on what you're saying.
Yes.
You mentioned in your input that you transfer funds for teacher development to provincial departments.
No, we don't. Our funding, just to clarify funding, our funding comes from teachers directly.
I understand that. So you said in your input,
I'm sorry,
that there is money allocated that you give to the provinces. Now, I just want to clarify that is not the case, or it is the case.
No, it's not the case. I'm sorry if I said that. Because
you're
department,
talking about grants and
that's
so on.
Right, yes.
Okay,
yes.
That's fine.
Thanks.
Chairperson and honorable members, I don't have very much to add as an introduction, just to say that we are the Council for Educators, and we have oversight of the teaching profession. And for that reason, we would, as a council that represents the teachers, like to applaud the new government for stating that education is priority number one. That does empower teachers to commit themselves to the work when they see that there is support and government structures are really walking the talk with regard to prioritizing education. So we do want to thank the government. We want to thank our Minister for Basic Education for being very supportive of teachers and listening to their voices with this recent implementation of the new curriculum review. Those things do help teachers commit themselves better to education. And the Minister for Basic Education attended the World Teachers Day celebration in Kimberley, which was co-hosted by the department, National Department, and by SACE. And again, speaking to those educators, it restores the morale of the profession, and we cannot emphasize how important it is to protect our teachers, the morale of teachers, and to help them continue to believe that they are doing an important job for the country. That is very, very important. We need to acknowledge that the teachers face obstacles, and we deal with some of those. If I could just briefly refer, when it comes to ethics, that happens to be my portfolio in the new council. We're dealing with teachers who've contravened our code of conduct, but we notice so many of them have done that because they've been under severe stress or that there hasn't been sufficient support for school discipline. A teacher had thrown stones thrown at her, and in response she then hit a child, and that would then make her guilty of an offense in terms of the code. And we need to enable teachers to do their work with a commitment without some of these obstacles to their work. So that's just by way of some recent example. We also need to enable our teachers by assisting them with this professional development. That comes again and again and again, and you've referred to it yourself, Chairperson, and our CEO has, and I cannot emphasize how important that is, and if we can ask for the House's support in whatever way they can give us with regard to promoting the professional development. Our mandated objective in terms of the legislation, and we will do it, but we also need to be enabled in terms of the funding, which is being referred to. So I want to assure the House that SAFE will work in partnership with all the structures to ensure that the education profession is a worthy profession and that the nation can become proud of our teachers with the assistance of all parties. Thank you.
No, thanks, Chair. And I'm going to take through the House through the presentation on PowerPoint, as you would say that. And there are some of the issues that my colleagues have already raised, which I don't think I would emphasize on. But you would look at the introduction there, as indicated, in terms of we are presenting this report to this House, which would indicate actually activities that we undertook as a council, which would indicate activities we undertook as a council and trying to give an account of all the activities that we've done in the previous year. And also in this report, we shall be presenting like our achievements in terms of the strategic objectives that we had set ourselves. And you would see that by means of the programs that we would indicate as we continue with this program. Also in this report, we'll be presenting challenges that this council is facing and what is it that we're doing to address some of the challenges, and I believe this House also would be in a position to assist us in terms of suggestions and proposals in terms of how best to address some of the challenges. The first program that we want to report to this House about is the registration program. Remember, as the CEO indicated earlier, that part of the mandate that we've been given by the Act is that we need to ensure that all educators are registered with the Council. And the program then, the strategic objectives that we had set ourselves for last year was that we need to make sure that we register all qualifying educators, that we also look at maintaining a credible database for all those registered educators. And in terms of our performance for the previous financial year, is that we actually managed to register 20,774 educators. And the breakdown of such registrations are, we gave full registration, those teachers who qualify fully for our registration, who meet the whole criteria for registration. We gave full registration to 12,372 educators, and we had 5,281 educators provisionally registered. The reason for provisional registration is that those educators do not meet the complete criteria for full registration, it says. And we have registered 2,259 foreign educators last year, and we have registered 862 new ECD practitioners during the previous year. And in terms of our analysis of progress in relation to registration, we are reporting to this House today that we believe indeed that we have exceeded expectations in terms of what we had set ourselves as a target, that we need to register all educators. And we could indicate to this House that all applications that were received by SAFE last year, in actual fact, all of them have been processed. And the House would understand when we're talking processing of those applications. Processing is a process. Some have already, we have gone through completion of processing them, but some are still in the process of being finalized. The CEO has talked about the database. That has been our problem all along, that our database has not been, I would say, current, but there are mechanisms that we're working on currently to make the database current. He has indicated that you find that in our database we still have teachers who have passed on and so on and so on, and we're working hard with our IT division to make sure that the database speaks to the teachers that are currently alive if I may use the term. But currently on our database, it would show that we have 533,739 educators on our current database. The second program, which we are glad that the chair of this house also has spoken to, is the question of professional development. In terms of this program, our targets were as follows, that we need to make sure that we facilitate the professional development of educators, that we need to be certain as a council that we know and understand the current challenges that are there in the profession and be able to make recommendations in terms of how we deal with those challenges going forward. That we also need to make sure that we promote and enhance the status of the teaching profession. The reports that we want to give to the House in terms of our performance for the previous financial year is that, one, in relation to professional development of teachers in this country and the new program that is coming up of CPTD, which I believe Mr. Porter will be able also to speak to at length in terms of the program. But what we could report for now is that the CPTD design document has been finalized, that structures that need to respond to the CPTD program have already been established, structures like your endorsement committee, structures like your teacher support and provider support units, those structures have already been established, and also that the CPTD ICT system is now up and running, and we could indicate to this house that already there is a program running in relation to CPTD where we are piloting this project in about 144 schools in the country. And this pilot most probably would have to last until, in terms of our projection, October 2010, of which we would then be getting lessons in terms of how best are we implementing this project and how what changes we need to effect onto the program to make sure that it responds exactly to what we need. As I said, that the endorsement handbook has already been finalized. The handbook that would be speaking to which of the activities and how those activities would be endorsed by the council as anticipated in the National Framework for Teacher Education and Development. And in terms of ensuring that we deal with this question of professional development of educators, last year alone, we distributed 15,000 copies of the Professional Development Portfolio Guidelines to almost a number of educators, like I'm saying, 15,000 copies of that. The aim of this Professional Development Portfolio Guidelines, one of its key aims is that it would help teachers to track their progress in terms of development in the profession. And we have felt that, and we've got a sense, actually, a faith, that teachers are really welcoming this kind of initiative, which would assist them to track their development and progress within the profession. We have conducted workshops on both the professional development portfolio and the IQMS performance standard number 5, which managed to benefit about 10,000 educators in the country. And the target B in terms of understanding the dynamics and the challenges that are there in education, we have set up the CPTD research study on professional development practices, which we could report to this council, to this committee, that research study has now been completed. And it's the council that would still be looking at that report and maybe in no time would be able to produce that report. We conducted a seminar last year on teacher supply and demand, and I believe members of the House Chair would understand that there is a big debate in the country about whether is there a shortage or an oversupply of teachers in our country. At the same time, we felt it is imperative on ourselves as a professional council that we conduct this seminar jointly with the Department of Education, where there are recommendations that are coming up at this stage that are showing us whether what is it that we need to do in terms of making sure that every class, every minute has a teacher. And this question of teacher demand and supply becomes then central to ourselves as a council. The second target, that of making sure that we actually
are able to promote and enhance the status of the teaching profession. We held a World Teachers Day celebration last year in KwaZulu-Natal. Like we're saying, the main event was held in KwaZulu-Natal. But that's not only the event that takes place in terms of World Teachers Day, but throughout the country, schools write to SAYS requesting information on how best they could celebrate World Teachers Day. And as SAYS, more especially the Professional Development Unit at SAYS, is very much keen and is always assisting schools in terms of supplying such information and also providing schools with opportunities where they could interact with ourselves in terms of what our expectations, like giving out to schools the theme for the particular year, making sure that schools, provinces, and everybody understands what theme are we dealing with in a particular year. Like we're saying, last year only, in terms of the reports that we received, over 20,000 educators participated in the World Teachers Day celebrations. And normally, as SAYS, what we do before any World Teachers Day celebration day, we go about on a, if we have targeted a particular province, we make sure, like in KwaZulu-Natal, that we visited a number of regions, districts, where we are popularizing this World Teachers Day, making sure that educators understand what the World Teachers Day is about, making sure that communities understand what we mean as a professional council when we talk to everybody need to celebrate and honor our teachers on that particular day. So we're saying over 20,000 actually educators participated in that program last year. The second target that we set ourselves for last year, which I would term program number three, was the question of the code of ethics. And the CEO has spoken about this, and the deputy chair of council has actually spoken about that. The targets that we had set ourselves for last year were, we need to make sure that we review the code of ethics. In terms of the SAYS Act, it gives us actually the mandate that we need from time to time to review the code of ethics. And that is what we did last year, and I'll be giving a report as I proceed. That we need to also ensure that all complaints and cases that are reported to ourselves are investigated, are finalized in terms of our disciplinary procedures. Our actual performance chair is that last year we managed to do a reviewal. Last year we managed to do a reviewal of that code of ethics, and after reviewing the code, we had to reprint other codes, and they were distributed throughout the profession. Our aim actually is that each school must have at least two copies of the code of ethics, each school. And we could report to this house today that we believe we are achieving in that regard, because in any school that you get to today, you'd be able to pick up and find that code displayed somewhere. The aim of displaying this code is to make sure that teachers from time to time are able to refer to the code so that they are able to check on themselves in terms of what it is that they are doing in ensuring that they comply with the provisions of the code. We convened last year a workshop on the SAYS Act. The CEO has spoken about it, and there are recommendations which we believe, honestly, that this House will be able to interact with in no time, which talks to amendments that we are proposing towards the SAYS Act, and that is a process matter. Already these amendments have been handed over or presented to the Department of Education, and we believe processes are already in place in terms of addressing such. In relation to target B of investigating, ensuring that we investigate and we finalize complaints that are received by SAYS, we want to indicate to the House that in actual fact last year we received about 318 complaints about educators, 318 complaints about educators. We want to report that 50 of these complaints have been finalized, and the complaints could be classified as follows. We received complaints that relate to verbal abuse by educators, and the number of complaints that we received are 24. We received 35 complaints of sexual misconduct against our educators. And I believe if members of the House would also agree that in terms of the newspaper reports recently, we were getting a number of negative reports around teachers who have sexual relationships with learners, teachers who have raped learners, and so on. And that is one matter that SAIS is taking up as a priority, actually, to make sure that such cases, serious as they are, they receive our most urgent attention. We have received about 56 reports of cases on fraud. We received about 3 cases relating to racism, 62 cases relating to corporal punishment, and I think one of the things that Elsa also raised there as part of the cases that we pick up is that teachers will tell you that they're so frustrated. This learner sometimes are unruly. They're very unruly to such an extent that we have not given them an alternative, because once corporal punishment was banished or was abolished, and there has been no much kind of vigor in terms of programs that deal with alternatives to corporal punishment. And therefore, you find in most cases that teachers would still, in one way or the other, apply corporal punishment, and unfortunately, because it's outlawed, those cases then get reported to SAIS, and we need to deal with them. We received about 114 cases of unprofessional conduct from our educators, which is quite a scary number, which is one number that we need to look at reducing as much as possible. We received about 2 complaints of negligence of duty. We received 1 complaint of murder. But if I could talk to this complaint of murder, it's not a complaint that relates to an educator murdering a learner. But it's something that happens outside of the schooling kind of system. But then communities then will take a decision that we are reporting this case because teacher A has murdered a person. And therefore, states will need to deal with that kind of process. And I think that case is still pending and it's still under our processes. And there were 23 cases reported to SAIS that we did not have jurisdiction on. Some of the cases you find that are cases that happened long time before your 1998, because we cannot deal with cases that occurred in your 1996 or what, because the Act tells us that we only have jurisdiction on cases where we started operating under the SAIS Act. That is then about S6, the number of cases that we have received. On publicity and communication, Chairperson, we had a program and our targets were that we need to make sure that we build the image of the teaching profession and also deal with the corporate identity of this profession and also deal with the question of outreach programs. And members of the House would remember in dealing with the intentions of the, I would say, the image building, last year already we invoked a debate as council that we need the profession to start debating the question of the dress code. We are saying schools must start debating the question of the dress code. And as council we were certain ourselves that it may not be easy for us to come out and be prescriptive to schools to say this is the kind of dress code that we're looking at. But we are saying we would recommend as council that let's start debate on the dress code, because a good number of some of the complaints that we are receiving is about the question of your dress code, the attitude of educators, and so on, in terms of their appearance, and so on. But those are the things that we think schools start debating the things. So that at the level of schools, if people agree on a particular dress code, I think that would assist in terms of building the corporate image of the profession. We have, in terms of communication, on outreach, went out to talk to a number of educators, publicizing the activities of SAIS, ensuring that educators are aware of their professional council, aware of what we stand for, or aware of our mandate. These are some of the publications that we managed to distribute in the previous year. We distributed about 1,000 SAIS diaries. We distributed about 3,500 copies of the annual report last year. We distributed about 40,000 copies of the World Teachers Day posters, actually. We distributed about 20,000 A5 booklets on the SAIS Act. We distributed 40,000 SAIS information packs that talks to the whole notion of SAIS. The division that SAIS, what their responsibilities are, how do people communicate with faith, and so on and so on. And we distributed 40,000 World Teachers Day brochures. We also participated, colleagues, in a number of radio interviews trying to publicize our activities as a council. And as part of participating in those radio interviews, actually, it's not only about publicizing, but about bringing to the attention of society what is it that is our thinking and faith in relation to this profession. We participated talking about the code of ethics in those radio interviews, trying to indicate to society that you are aware of some of the things that are happening, and these are the steps we are taking in terms of ensuring that we deal with those matters. We participated in a number of professional teacher union conferences because we believe, as their stakeholders, when they invite us or when they convene their conferences, be it a province, region, and so on, we avail our services and we avail our stands so that teachers would have that interaction with faith. We also participated in the ETDP CETA conference. We conducted school visits in 5 clusters in KwaZulu-Natal during that period of the World Teachers Day, World Teachers Week, actually. And as part of our project of ensuring that our services are brought closer to our educators, the Faith Council has taken a decision, actually, that we need to move a step further now and establish provincial offices. And already want to report to this House that we are in communication with the 3 provinces that have been identified, KwaZulu-Natal, the Eastern Cape, and Mpumalanga, with the intention of establishing provincial offices, and we could report that we believe progress is being made in that regard. Challenges that we are facing as a council. I think one of the challenges that we are facing is the challenge of accommodation. That's been one of our challenges. Our accommodation in relation to our own central office, to such an extent that as a council we took a decision to purchase a building in Pretoria so that we could then be able to operate from our own building. Because currently, what is obtaining that we have been operating from the ELRC on a squatting kind of basis, and as the ELRC is growing on its own, they would be needing that space, which would compromise some of our operations of space. And that's why we took this conscious decision that we need to look at purchasing our own building. One of the other challenges is the question of support for the CPTD system. We want to report to this House that we are getting the full support from the Department of Education in relation to the implementation of the CPTD system. However, as the CEO indicated also earlier, that due to financial constraints that also the Department of Education is facing these days, we're finding that support getting very minimal. And central to this program, where we're talking teacher development, actually, we believe this House would be able to assist us in understanding or with recommendations in terms of how we could best address that kind of option. Because I think at one stage we are left with no option except to debate whether should we reduce the pilot project to a lesser school because of financial constraints, but we felt as a council that no, we need to go ahead and do this pilot in the 144 schools. But the question of funding for CPTD programs is one question that I think we need to get ourselves clear on in terms of how and how best that could be resolved. And as the chair was trying to clarify with the CEO the question of the funding, in actual fact, what he was saying, there is funding that is located in provincial education department, funding that has to deal with teacher development, actually. And we're saying such funding, in our own sense, is not actually utilized to the best of teacher development. And therefore, maybe we need a discussion in terms of how best can we make sure that such funding gets redirected, maybe to respond to this question of CPTD. Unfortunately, the minister is also accommodative to that, and those are things that we're trying to explore. Also, one of the challenges is that due to our own constraints, it may be our wish that we reach out to the profession as much as possible. It may be our wish that we make sure that we publicize ourselves essays as much as possible. Because that members of the profession sometimes would say to us that they don't understand and they don't know anything about SAIDS. To us, it's really a serious kind of challenge. But because of them constraints, that's one of the challenges that we're facing. But as council has recently taken decisions to look at our resource base and so on, we believe that challenge would be able to deal with in the coming financial year. Mr. Mapindane, would you take us through the financial report?
I would like to request the House to ignore the first slide. There are some shift of numbers which make those numbers not to say what we wanted to represent. I'll refer you to look at page 42 of the annual report regarding that slide. It covers the financial position of the council, which when you look at it, it talks of if we were talking about the wealthness, we would say CIS is operating on a poor organization, because you look at the rents there, which are managing this profession with such a huge responsibility. We work on small scale of rents, but be as it may, we are managing to achieve our goals. The financial position is as follows. When you look at it, we are having 21 million assets, of which 16 of those assets are non-liquid. The building and the equipment, the office furniture. When you look at our liquid assets, we only have cash. Which in March we had only cash of 4.7 million, which when you compare it to the liabilities, when you go down there, our liabilities were more than the liquid cash we had. The council sat down and realized that that has got an impact in terms of the continuity of the council. At that time, they took a decision to increase its levies by 1 rand. Which when you count in percentage, 1 rand per month to 5 rand per month, it's a huge percentage. But I think they considered it reasonable at that time. They took a decision. It was implemented with effect from April 1st to ensure that the council continues with its mandate. I would like to also highlight that when you look down under the current liabilities, you'll find a figure written deferred income of 3.6. That is the money which we received from the Department of Education in respect of CPTD as a CPTD grant. We could not utilize that money by the end of March. It never meant that we couldn't utilize it, because there were projects which were going on at that time. They were still in the process, like the ICT development, which anyway we had to pay such in terms of the progress made after March. So it was recorded as deferred amount. So that money by now, as I'm talking, has already been utilized. I think in terms of the financial position, that's as it is. I'm done. We can go to the next one, which is the financial performance, which is known as the income statement. The simplified one, you'll find it on page 60, and even the slide, it's in good order. When you look on the revenue, you'll see that we collect money from registration and our membership fee, which is the main source of our revenue, and we do get the CPTD grant from the Department of Education, which it amounted to 30 million, and we, in terms of spending, we ended up spending 31,567,000, which led us to a deficit of 270,921. After mentioning that deficit, I will say we had some few items which we did not comply to the statutory requirements, of which the main one is PFMA, to say that we have overspent, which is a non-compliance, by 279.21. That money was approved by council. They spent it on professional development activities. And it was funded by the surplus we generated the previous year. Again, in terms of the non-compliance, I'll refer you to the audit opinion, which is on page 39 of the annual report, which the first one speaks to, the major one speaks to the unauthorized, irregular, or fruitless expenditure, which amount to 179,176. This was looked at by council and the audit committee. I'll also refer you to the report of the audit committee regarding that, which is on page 29. Yeah, on page 29, irregular expenditure. The audit committee as well adjudicated over that, and the explanation is as follows, is that we had a World Teachers Day function around KwaZulu-Natal. In terms of the conferencing and accommodation, it so happened that one of our delegated person omitted to sign the bill after the event on the spot. They left, and that bill was not certified on the spot, which in terms of the PFMA requirement, that should not have happened. It should have been signed on the spot to certify that that expenditure, we are convinced that really is correct. But the orders were issued. It was an authorized function. It took place. The next item regarding the non-compliance, still on that audit opinion, it's about the issue of our revenue, the membership fee. I think you'll recall that the CEO indicated that our database needs some cleanup, which we do have a process in place to clean it up, which it still has people who left the profession, some of them who passed on. So the system that we do have currently, it's not able to pick up such gaps because the people are still on our database, but we don't know what happened to them. We are in the process of cleaning it up and try to ensure that we are sure of the revenue that we should receive for the coming year than to receive it as it comes. I would say we performed very well. And we do have good cooperation from the Department of Education. We had some interactions during the course of the year and tried to see where can we improve. Even the issue of the revenue collection, we did have an interaction with them and to see how are we moving. They were convinced that the direction we have taken will take us somewhere soon, which we believe the following financial year, being 2009 and 10, will comply. Thank you.
Thanks, Mr. Abinani. Mr. Polo, any additions on the professional development? Okay, thanks, Chair.
No. Thanks, Chair. That is our presentation now. We are in your hands.
We're going to break up the sessions a little bit in terms of the substance of your report and then the financials, if you don't mind. And I'd like to start with the financials because I think that kind of informs a lot of your activities and so on. Let me just make the overall comment that, you know, the annual report and the financial statements really just leaves a lot to be desired in terms of the understandability of the way it's been presented. The notes, you know, one has to look through the annual report to find the relevant note to the particular statement. I'm not quite sure why it is that we can't present the statements in an orderly way, and the notes attached to that, that they can make sense to somebody who's not a financial guru. Now, all of the stuff that you would say would make sense to the CFO behind you, but it doesn't make sense to me. So I've got no sense when, for example, I mean, a lot of, and this is unfortunately the clarion cry when it comes to the public finances generally. Is even the categories that you talk to, your intangible assets, you know, one is left wondering what is that. The notes are not very, very clear, and they don't really cut. So it's just a general comment I want to make. Where there's references to a particular page, you turn to that page. If I were to just allude to it, page 60, you say there's a heading called expenses, and then you say refer to 28. When you go to 28, you've got a picture. Do you know? That's what I'm saying, is that it becomes really irritating, and this is not the only annual report that we have to deal with. We have to deal with many annual reports. So for us to even just read the stuff, you know, make it easy for us to read it and understand what you're trying to present is all I'm saying as far as the finances are concerned. I'm going to let members ask questions on the finances, but I don't see any eager hands right now. But I do want to ask this question. You mentioned in your presentation there was an increase in the fees. Now, I know that in the annual report somewhere there was some indication to that effect, and I'm not sure where exactly. But I seem to recall that the increase was much higher. Am I completely gone off my head when I say that? I'm correct.
Just
take us to...
I would say it's in terms of the presentation, this report covers events which took place up to the end of March. So the increase that I'm talking about, it happened in terms of the decision which the council took just after looking at the financial position as reflected at the end of March. They took a decision to say that, no, in terms of our performance, financially wise, we don't have money to fund our activities. Let's take a decision to increase the levy for the next financial year. It started to be effective 1st of April, which means we'll report this year. We'll report on it when next year.
Yeah, is that you've got an increase as you point out of 1 rand. Now, I don't know where that is, and as you say, it doesn't fall within this reporting period, so that's why it's not here. But you've got here the property was acquired at 12 million in February 2008, right, which falls within the reporting period. The council has already finalized the renovation plans, estimated at 48 million. The council has approved an increase in levies from 72 rand per annum to 240 rand per annum, effective 1 October 2009. Levies, I take it, from your membership, in terms of fees. That is a 200 and almost 25% increase in the levies that you are proposing. That's even bigger than ESCOM. I mean, that's just for me a bit outrageous. If that's the case, it may be, I may be wrong.
I won't use the word outrageous, but I think it is something that the council has considered
for over 18 months because we are in a very awkward position of our landlord wanting to kick us out. You've heard that we are squatting in the ELRC building. At the moment, we are being squeezed out so much that we have to rent the two buildings on either side of ourselves. And one of the big requirements is to do the CPTD work. We need a whole two floors of infrastructure to do the CPTD work. So space is a big requirement. We have been engaging...
Let me finish this.
It's important.
Okay.
The House needs to understand this. Because we have been engaging with the Ministry and the Department of Education on this matter, and there have been a number of ideas coming about us getting the premises issue resolved. Now, Council has given this as an in-principle decision, as a way out of this. We have negotiated, we've met with the Minister a week ago about the very same matter, and the Minister is now coming up with a slightly amended plan, and she is also shares your view that this is quite a big jump. You know, members won't see it as a building fund for 1 year kind of thing. So it is a matter that has not been quite settled yet.
Let me tell you quite categorically, I'm opposed to this. And I'll tell you why. Because there are other options to be considered rather than purchasing a building and renovating it for 48 million or whatever it is that you want.
No, ma'am, thanks. Your view will be noted.
I appreciate... No. I want you to take very serious note of it because we find ourselves in a recession. We do not have teachers who get the kind of increases that you and your council members get. They are also struggling teachers. Now, if you want teachers to embrace the council and to really regard it as a champion for their professional development and so on, you cannot raise fees from 72 rand to 240 rand per annum based on the amount that teachers earn.
That's exactly what the minister says.
The problem is that I don't see in your annual report, and you may have considered all other options with the council, and I'm sure that, as you say, you spoke about it for 18 months, but let us see those things. Let us see what are the other options that you considered. One of the things that we have done is we've gone to the new premises of the Department of Education. And what was meant initially about 2 or 3 years or 5 years ago as a new building and new premises to house the whole Department of Education as it was is now only going to accommodate basic education. So in other words, this premises is going to be far too big for the Department of Education. There's absolutely no reason why that should not be an option to be considered, either on a rental basis, a lease basis, or whatever it is, or even perhaps a long-term option for you to involve yourself with the private partner that they have on that premises. All I'm saying is that I do not think it's fair for, and as much as you may need the accommodation, and as much as it hampers your day-to-day operations, I do think that you have to take very seriously the issue of teachers struggling in this very terrible economic time that we do have. And for us to be as lavish as we are in terms of renovations and so on, for me, it sticks in the throat. So I do think that at the very least what we're going to ask you to do is to give us a full report from the council on these options that you've considered and what your plans are for the future and whether you're still, and if you are still going to proceed with this, we would want you to come back to the portfolio committee and come and explain to us why you're doing this. So that's the stance that I certainly am going to take, and I'm not sure if there are members here who oppose this position. So there you have it. Any other comments, CFO?
Sorry, I just thank you, ma'am. I respect that view, and I think the deputy chair just wants to make a point.
Sure.
Thank you. I understand the viewpoint that you hold, chairperson. I'm a teacher. The council members, the large majority are, in fact, teachers. And we've gone into this with certainly with our eyes wide open. The real problem is that we start with such a low base. Our levies are so low compared with other professional organizations, even if we take other relatively poor professions like the nurses. And we just have not been able to complete the work of council to the satisfaction of teachers. Wherever we go on our outreach missions, when we go on these road shows to meet the teachers, they are asking and expecting the council to do things, which we should be doing, but we in fact don't have the resources to be doing it. So we're not meeting the needs of educators, even in terms of our legislative mandate. So we're in a difficult situation here. And then the other thing is regarding the dignity of the educators. How SAFE is operating at the moment really is not respectful to the profession. In basements of buildings, you know, living out of boxes because we are camping in two buildings, three buildings, I suppose, if we take the ELRC building. It's really not good for the profession, and the profession wants to see SAFE in the provinces, and so this increased levy would enable SAFE to be present in the provinces in a partnership with the ELRC. So it was enabling council to do more of the work that it is supposed to be doing. It was a difficult decision, not a popular decision even amongst council, but an inevitable one.
We will get back to how much of your fees you actually spend on professional development as opposed to infrastructure and other costs that you have, and that's a separate debate that we're going to have now. But the truth of the matter is that there's still options. It doesn't need to be an undignified building, and it doesn't need to be an undignified operation that you have. I'm saying that there are more cost-effective ways of doing this, especially where we find ourselves in these times of recession. The fact that you've had to increase it to such an extent doesn't speak to professional development. It speaks to your building, and that's my problem. You're not coming here to say we have to increase it to X amount simply because we want to extend professional development. That's not what you're saying. You're coming here and you're saying to me, we need these buildings and so on. And that's the worry that I do have. So we'll get the report from you, and we'll reconsider based on what you give to us and so on. But as things stand, I think that this is an issue that you must understand that is of primary concern to us.
You wanted to make a point, Chair, could you just allow one quick comment?
Thanks, Jan. What I just wanted to say is that despite the fact that we are all going on with this particular debate, it might be a bit stale on the discussions because the report is talking to what has happened. Remember that one thing, despite the fact that council has taken the approval or taken decision to increase from 72 to 240, it depended on the minister agreement that, which she hasn't. We've met
we
with
will
her.
Oppose it to the minister, is what I'm
saying. She hasn't agreed.
I know.
Okay.
I know.
So we have adhered to what the minister has told us. The options of the building of the department, we've discussed it, and the money has gone down. So what I'm saying is that in the report that will come in next, it is not going to be 240 at all, but there are options because one of the key things, this 240 was supposed to be only for 1 year and then reviewed. What the minister then was raising, despite being opposed to 240, what she was saying is that, are you saying the teacher will pay 6 rand, go to 20 rand for 1 year, then review it again to 6 rand? Will you be able to afford what you're doing? Because currently, as you're saying, our biggest problem is professional development coming in with the CPDD. What we're then saying is that what the minister needs is what you're saying. Instead of us having 6 rand being paid, which is not sufficient for our professional development, let's look at an amount that will be able to sustain faith, not only for the building, but for the entire problem that we're all about. So when we come back to report what we've then discussed and agreed upon with the minister, which needs now to go back to our council to say, this is what the minister has advised, this is what we're going to be doing, does council agree? So it will not be what is on the paper right now, because currently what is standing on the paper has been already been discussed and reviewed with the minister, because she didn't agree, but she gave us options that are workable. And then, so that's why I'm saying this debate might go in a different way, but it has already sort of shifted after we met with the minister on last week, on Thursday. So the debate is a bit stale. I would not want members to go on this figure, which is not
currently the figure that the minister is agreeing on, and we're moving on.
No, that's fine. I take the point that this is, may not be the figure, but the point in principle still remains that the increment, whether it's 240 or 200, is still huge money that we're talking about. And for our part, we remain to be convinced that this is the appropriate way to go. And we certainly would want a full report from yourself as to the status quo currently, where you are with discussions with the minister, and we would want you to convey, as we will too, to the minister, that when you got to the portfolio committee, this was the view that was held. Okay? So we're going to, unless anybody else wants to speak to this particular item, we're going to deal with other issues. And let's talk to the auditor's reports in particular. The issue of the various points made by the auditors, not just in terms of the financials, but also the performance indicators. The emphasis of matter. You've spoken already to the irregular expenditure. Just remind me. I do not understand what you explained to be what the auditors are saying. They're saying that there was no proper authorization process. Could you maybe just explain that? What do they mean by that?
According to their statement, it says more, but actually what happened, which is explained by the audit committee, is that the process itself affects the situation where the moment the function takes place and you get a bill, somebody has to sign it on the spot before it's billed as an invoice, the attachment, the details. So in this case, the details of that conference and who was booked in which room, how much per each person, per each room, that nobody was standing there by the hotel at the end of the function to sign all those, as it was a conference package. But the orders were already placed before the function. The function was authorized by council. The orders were placed, but it's only that omission of somebody signing immediately when the function comes to an end. Of all whatever we hired, the room cost and all those, that's the omission which took place. But in terms of the PFMA, that on its own, it's classified under one section which speaks about the unauthorized, fruitless, and as it's written there.
Anybody on the auditor's report, Mr. Smith?
Chairperson, according to the auditor, pages of the documents on page 60 and 61 mm-hmm. were not taken into account when the auditor expressed the opinion on the financials of yeah. this office. So I think that in itself is also a huge shortcoming in my view when the Auditor General is expressing that, because it relates to two important documents, one that indicates the deficit, which places the deficit into high question, and the other one is about the financial performance, which say that some of those expenses and whatever has been done with the finances is also questionable. So I would like states to give us an indication whether they are satisfied, whilst from my side I'm not satisfied with that kind of thank you.
Chair,
According to what is captured on page 40 in that auditor's report, they indicate that those schedules, what the procedure they use, they work on samples. They pick up one account, like the one which they regarded as an irregular. They picked it up from those line items. But what they are saying is that they did not audit one by one up to the totals, but they took samples for each category and make their own opinion. So their opinion is based on samples. So, but they are saying they did not go through each and every item of those details to agree to each and every total, but they took samples. That's what the interpretation normally is.
So you're saying those statements did serve before them?
Yes, they were served before them, and they took samples for each line item as they felt necessary. But what they did not do, they are saying, for example, if you go to CPTD project, they did not go through each and every invoice for CPTD, but they took samples. Like the 179 is part of the professional development, which is part of those page 60 and 61. So it's they picked it when they picked up a sample.
Chair, perhaps that's clarity. On page 43 of the financial statement, we receive a statement of financial performance, which is basically a summarized version of page 60 and 61. Now, in terms of the audit practices, page 60 and 61 does not form part of the financial statements as such, and therefore they don't express an opinion there too. The actual statement is the one on page 43 on which they do express an opinion.
Now, what is this deficit that you're now currently operating on? I was reading the Act, and while it doesn't say anything specifically about whether you can operate a deficit, I think it was probably an oversight. It seems that there is a clause there that seemed to indicate that one of the intentions with the people who were originally passing the Act was that there should never be a deficit. Not that they've stipulated it clearly enough, in my opinion. But what measures? I mean, I'm not sure how this operates, because one of the things that you do is you operate by way of fees coming in. So clearly you can, in a practical sense, operate by way of a deficit, because you always have monies coming in. But it's not necessarily the best thing to see under the circumstances. What would you attribute the deficit to in terms of the increases year on year? Operating expenses, no doubt.
Let me say, we acknowledge that was an oversight to happen, that we overspend. It's not allowed in terms of the Act. But one issue that...
So you read it like that as well, that you're not allowed to operate the deficit?
It's not allowed. In our case, I think we mentioned it even earlier, that in terms of our revenue, the main revenue, it's difficult to project how much we're going to get because of this issue of teachers passing on, and we don't get the information on time. But we work close to the figure. So it happened that we did not get the necessary revenue projected. Then it set us off by that amount, which... Now, the system which we are trying to implement, we are cleaning up that database to ensure that we budget on the completely guaranteed members, of which fluctuations will take place, but we'll try to work it out in such a way that we work it on a safer side than to come close to it. But the time when we have pressure, you find that we'll try to work it a little bit far less, but we are pressurized to deliver, like it happened last year.
Now, it seems to me that one of the ideas behind stipulating this thing in the Act was to actually ensure that there is a reserve fund on an ongoing basis to deal with and to cushion these kinds of uncertainties that you have in terms of your fees and so on. So you would, I mean, in terms of good financial management, you would sort of assess and say, well, at least 5% of our fees we're not sure of whether we're going to get from time to time, and therefore have a cash reserve on hand, surely. And what you're saying is that the cash reserve of 5.8 last year in the last financial year, and then 4.7 in the current one under review, was insufficient to cushion the deficit.
As I've indicated, is that the year before this one, we had a surplus. So when the council debated these things, they said, no, it's fine. We had a surplus which covered such a deficit, which means the council could fund its own deficit. We used that deficit to cover that. So it was covered by the council.
So it was covered.
Yes.
Okay. Well, that's, I think, what I was missing. The biggest expenditure, you see, I don't have a sense of what your biggest expenditure is, but I imagine it's your human resources at this stage, right? And what you've provided is the salaries and bonuses and so on. Where is it? Oh, yeah, on page 58, where your executive management remuneration is stipulated. Now, both Ms. Mapindani and Mr. Briraj's salaries and fringe benefits and all these other things are stipulated. But I don't have any sense of the rest of the contingent in terms of the year-on-year, you know, salary increases or anything of that sort in a tabular form as we have here. So you've given us ballpark figures for wages and salaries and so on in the financial statements, but we don't have a breakdown. I think in the future what you need to do is to give us that breakdown. Certainly, while we don't necessarily expect you to do a tabulation for every single wage earner, but certainly I think you can see which ones are the significant spends and give us those breakdowns, and then the others you can just do by category. So clerks, you can tell us five and then give us that. I think it's just to give you a sense of what we would require in future annual reports as well. But if we could get a separate report just detailing it for the year under review, that would also be of assistance so that we can measure from year to year where we're going in terms of your salary budgets and so on. Okay. Members, anything further on the financial statements? Sure.
On a specific amount, on one of the slides, they refer to the $40,000 for the World Teachers Day posters. What amount was spent on this whole celebration or day or conference in KwaZulu-Natal? And why only in KwaZulu-Natal? Was it a national conference? Was it only for this specific province?
Okay, thank you. I think, as Temba was saying when he was presenting, when we do a World Teachers Day in KwaZulu-Natal, we're doing it throughout the provinces. So when we send out posters, we send them throughout the entire provinces, but the main function, we target a particular province. So KwaZulu-Natal was the main province that was being targeted for 2008. But our posters and everything else that schools ordered from us, we sent throughout the province, but each and every school in a province can be able to celebrate the World Teachers Day. So the amount, more or less, with our budget is always around a million rand that we use to ensure that each and every school across the country, which is something we couldn't do this year because the budget was quite tight.
But we choose one particular province per year to celebrate the main function, but all other provinces do have posters and functions being sent to them so that they can be able to have the worship there, and schools are able to order these packs from faith, and we send them to the school so that they have these particular packs so that they can be able to celebrate the worship day. But for now, we cannot have a national one where each and every province we are able to run and have a national worship. So we have a decision from council to say we choose one particular province where the main function on the 5th of October will be, and the rest of other provinces can do as they plan. We'll just give support in terms of material.
In other words, only people from KwaZulu-Natal attended this conference. And why KwaZulu-Natal specifically?
We're trying to rotate the way we're doing our work today. For example, 9th of October last week on Friday, we were in Kimberley. Our province for this year was Northern Cape. So we try and rotate in all the 9 provinces so that we don't have a province that feels that faith hasn't come to make the major one day in a particular province. So the decision of council that we cannot go to all provinces, but each and every year we do it on a rotational basis of which province we're going. So for KwaZulu-Natal 2008, 2009 was Northern Cape. We have to decide for the 2010 World Teachers Day where the function is. So people who attended was from KwaZulu-Natal at that point in time.
And the second question was about the cost.
For last year, for World Teachers Day, it came to 1.2. These include the event in KwaZulu-Natal and the interactions we had with the entire country.
Can you perhaps give us a breakdown of that amount, 1.2? More or less. How did you spend that money for one province? In other words, the province has to wait 9 years before you get to a certain province, the last province. And what is the breakdown of this 1.2?
I would like to apologize for not having the details as requested on the spot, but I can just indicate the nature of expenses that we do incur. Like what we do at first, we know that we're going to have World Teachers Day in October. As early as June, July, what do we do? We try the newspapers. We normally use the teacher, which goes to each and every school, to advertise, to sensitize teachers about this activity that they should try and have celebrate this World Teachers Day wherever they are. Then what comes next, we start looking at the provinces. Almost they tell us that most of them, they tell us that they're having functions. They start requesting our support. So that guides us to say what kind of support we can give them. We do send our officials to make presentations. And the other expense we do, which is a major one, it's where faith itself avails itself physically to that particular province to mobilize, to sensitize, to ensure that people really take this day seriously. What do we do before that event in that province? We have some communication with all stakeholders in education. Then we have a lot of meetings before that time. The last week before the event, we have what we call its outreach program in that province. We send our officials and all stakeholders assist us. We move around the entire province to ensure that each and every corner of that province know about this function and they do something about it. There are those who cannot make it to the central venue, but wherever they are, they should do something. We move with our own pamphlets, which we print to ensure that they have the theme of the year, they know the faith message of support, and we make sure that wherever they need help and we can afford, we assist them. So there are a lot of logistics involved while we are arriving at that day, but unfortunately, I will say my apologies that we may not have the details per each item.
You know, on this World Teacher Day thing, before you come in, look, I hesitate to say this, but I'll say it anyway. If you're spending 1 million odd for the province, and you then consider that as you evolve as an institution and as a body, that every year this is going to be an expenditure on your books, you catch my drift in terms of the amount that it's going to cost you, particularly if you're going to then want to reach all provinces and so on. And clearly, you know, you're doing the rotation now because it's practically and monetarily feasible for you to do so. But in the future, you might want to perhaps accelerate this. And I'm just wondering to what extent that should be your your area of focus, which is not to say that it shouldn't be an area of focus, given that you do represent, you're a professional body of educators, but to the extent that you are in the driving seat for this, as opposed to merely a role player and a stakeholder, if you're with me. If you were to look at other days dedicated to certain professions, it's usually the employer body that is meant to get to a point once a year that recognizes that is sensitive to the needs and really just sets aside a day for recognition of this profession. As opposed to necessarily being just lumped with the professional body representing the profession. So what I'm saying is I'm just a bit wary that this becomes entirely a safe issue to deal with every year, as opposed to a Department of Education employer body type of driven thing in which you are certainly a key stakeholder. So that it doesn't necessarily become a matter that you focus on in a material or in a driving way, if you're with me. Trying to not suggest by the same token that it's not an important event for teachers and so on. I think it is, but I think clearly there needs to be more synergies between the department and other stakeholders as to what, you know, I think I would like themes for the day. I would like them to focus on the issue of professional development, on the code of ethics, on those kinds of things, of which you clearly are a very big stakeholder. But I'm wondering to what extent that budget should really be coming out of your own coffers. So it's teachers paying for themselves, you know, that kind of thing. Yes, ma'am.
Thank you, ma'am. Maybe let's start with this one. When you say 1.2 million, it doesn't mean 1.2 million was spent on KwaZulu-Natal, all right? A certain portion, I think about 400,000, will go to KwaZulu-Natal. But as I said, as safe, our budget for the year for World Teacher's Day was 1.2 million for the year. That included tokens to each and every province that was celebrating, material to the provinces, any other thing that we might have to assist on. Only a little bit of the 1.2 is spent in KwaZulu-Natal because people are then in KwaZulu-Natal, which means the transporting and whatever, but the whole 1.2 million is not only for KwaZulu-Natal. It's a budget that we have for what is it, for the 9 provinces. But now the second thing that we've done, as I agree with you, from 2009, the World Teachers' Day is not a safe issue only. It was a joint venture because the minister that came in, so the World Teachers' Day for this year was a joint venture. There was a casting between SAFE and the department, which was done like that. And even now, for 2010, the minister has requested you have SAFE, you have each and every stakeholder to make sure that we celebrate this in full. So it might minimize our side of budgeting if we have more stakeholders coming in and coming to assist in financial wise. Otherwise, now it was training on us because we were the only ones who were making the key. But from 2010, there will be a difference because the department will come in and all the other stakeholders.
That's clarified the thing, and I think that's probably a good approach. But I do think also what Professor Kloppert-Lawrence has asked for is the actual breakdown of the amount spent. on World Teachers Day. And by that same token, I think what you will need to do again for the annual report, what we do with the department is we get every single unit in the department to come and give us their budget of the entire budget, if you're with me. So very much like that, I think what we would need is some sense of what each of your priorities actually cost in terms of your total budget. That, I think, is also lacking. So if you could maybe do a report of that nature, CFO, that would be very useful, I think, to all members here. Okay, is there any... Oh, yes, I did have you, sir. Sorry. No, behind you first and then yourself. Yeah, on the top.
Okay, thank you. Now, I see on page 16 an item on rental income. I just wanted to understand this because I think in the discussions the issue of accommodation came up, and I don't know, do you get income for renting out something? It's just a question of, clarity.
Thank you, ma'am. In terms of the rental income, when we purchased an old building in town, there were tenants who were renting. We continued with those contracts because they had contracts until where they ended. So they are all out at the moment. The last contract ended in April 2009, so for next year we may have only 1 month rental income. In terms of the other income, those are income which are not such major that we can define them to say this is kind of the income. If we had our professional code of professional ethics handbook, which including the professional PDP files, which the council took a decision that since the profession was in demand of those and we don't have money to provide all teachers because it was going into a lot of billions, they decided that those who are requesting, let's produce it for them and give it to them at a cost price. So that's the cost price, the money we spend to support the teachers, and we will recover it. The only thing is that we have to show it as income because it comes as cash, and on the other hand, we have already spent it.
Where are you housed at the moment? Where are you housed at the moment?
I need to answer that one. We're housed in Centurion, number 259, number 263, and number 265.
And that's Fisahi Place?
Fisahi is the new building that we bought and which we want to renovate.
But you've had tenants in there.
When we bought the building, because there were tenants, it's a huge building. So on the other side, there was a bakery. The other side, there were some people. So there were tenants that had contracts with the owner of the building. So when we bought the building, we inherited those contracts, which were ending, as the CFO is saying now, April 2009. So it gave us some income for the year whilst we were waiting to renovate the building. And now they've moved out. But currently, we are spread into three buildings next to each other in Centurion.
And the plan was to move into Fisahi at what stage?
By October 2009.
But that was the plan?
That was the initial plan when we bought the
Based
building.
Based on, of course, receiving your additional income. So. And now we are going to discuss this issue.
Yeah.
Which puts paid to your plan for October. And so you have to continue leasing these other three buildings that you've got.
Hence, we've leased now the other third building to say, whilst the plans are being deferred for moving to the building, let's find ways of accommodating ourselves. Because we had two, now we have
so
the third one.
So you do have an interim plan?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. I have Ms. Have you finished, sir? No, you. Have you done? Are you done with your? Okay. I just looked at your face and I thought you were not. You're not happy. Oh no, I'm very pleased about that, but that makes me worry about you.
No, you should be worried. I have issues, but sometimes I feel like a procedure.
But you are fine.
Yeah, I'm fine. For now, I'm fine.
Thank you.
They may not be very relevant here. That's why I feel.
No, it's perfectly fine. That's fine. We're going to get to the substance just now. As soon as Ms. Gina is given the opportunity to ask, but I see she's also withdrawing like you.
Yes, I am, but I think I'll get
to the substance. Okay. Well, let's then proceed to that issue. You want to start, Ms. Gina? Do you want to start with getting to the substance of the input? Okay, let me start. Look, I was reading the act with some interest, and I think you're right that there needs to be some, should we say, tightening up of some of the legislative provisions that you have. One of which was a question that I also had about the disciplinary thing. But what I'm still unclear about is this. If somebody has been disciplined, now maybe I'm going into the overall things a bit too soon, but okay, let's start here. The objects clause of the legislation, very clear. I mean, there's one thing in the legislation that's clear, the objects clause. Seeks to provide for registration of educators, professional development, and to maintain, protect the ethical standards of the profession, essentially. Those are your three main core objects, right? But over and above that, you have, under the powers and duties, you have almost an elaboration in regard to the objective. You have an elaboration under powers and functions, really. Of what you do. Now, for me, one of the things that is quite key, and I've said this to the department, and I've said it at various times as well. One of the biggest problems that we have, I think, in the education system, which was reiterated when we went to this workshop, is the number of people who are teachers but who are unqualified teachers. So this is over and above your further development and training focus that you have. And I just wondered, particularly with regard to Section 5B, 2, where one of your duties and powers as a counsel, and I want to read it, is must advise the minister on matters relating to the education and training of educators, including but not limited to the minimum requirements for entry to all levels of the profession, and then the standards of programs of pre-service and in-service teacher education, which is obviously your further education and training priority, and then the requirements for promotion, etc., etc. Now, the first one, which is the minimum requirements for entry, I think, and this is my view, I may be right, I may be wrong, I'm not an educationist but in terms of my background and so on, but the more I try and find out who occupies that space of what do we expect our future teachers to be qualified in, the more I realize that as the employer, the department has abdicated its responsibility in this regard, and it's put it firmly in the hands of higher education. And there are various routes, shall we say, to becoming a teacher. And there isn't something called. So, for example, I studied law, right? what is absolutely essential for the for degree purposes is agreed amongst the council of whatever law professors, whatever they call themselves. But taking on board what the Department of Justice agrees or disagrees with. So in other words, the Department of Justice then legislates what an LLB degree must consist of at its bare minimum. And you would remember a while ago they required Latin and Afrikaans and all of these things to be, you know, very core to and very uniformly applied to every single course of the LLB. So there may be differences, for example, between WITS, UCT or University of Natal or wherever else, right? But at its very core, there is an essential component of that degree. And then within that essential component of that degree, there are certain things within the curriculum of each of those core courses that have to be taught and that have to be covered in that course for that course to then be accredited as part of that or certainly complying with what is required as core. To what extent have you as a council looked at this issue? Made recommendations, if any, or conducted research?
Kitty, just a point before you come in. You're absolutely right, Chair, is that this is an area that SAFE must be more assertive in. And one has to admit that we have not been that assertive here. Just of late, that, and I'm glad you asked for the fuller organogram, with the kind of staff that you want to see. We are now putting in a research department as well. But we intervene and make sure, like right now, teachers must have a professional qualification to be fully registered with us. Although we condone for provisional registration, you understand, schools are battling. But we are saying that you must have a professional qualification that is of REQV-14. You know, the relevant the qualification value must be metric plus 4. So most teachers nowadays are coming out with that qualification, the new batch. And that is what council wants to aspire to. Presently, we would qualify REQV-13, but not many teachers come with that anymore. Those are the older teachers. So it is a four-year teaching degree that the council is looking for. We also intervene we work with the CHE and we have a good relationship with the HEQC. As I said in my opening comment, fortunately the department invite us to all of the meetings, ACWA and so on. So we have an inside view of what is the content of these teaching courses. And we have insisted, for example, there must be professionalism aspects, ethics, good conduct, you know, and there is a take. All of the tertiary institutions that we have interacted with, not one of them have resisted the idea of inculcating professionalism as that. And we've even gone further and registered those kind of potential teachers. But where we have not come up to our expectations is specifically also advising the minister in terms of these things. And that is the role that we want to play now. We are quite strong now. Our infrastructure, thanks to some of the levy increases, is good enough now. So we have a research wing, and we are going to, advise the minister, even on the question of supply and demand, the question of the actual number of unqualified teachers, which even the president is worried about. So you're right to show concern there, and it is a matter that we are going to take more seriously. Siri, I don't know if there's any other specific here.
No, Chair, what I was going to say is just that when you were highlighting on the law part, that is the one thing that's been lacking in education. There is no particular body within even the department itself that could specify what needs to be done in universities that train teachers. Hence the discrepancy when it came to the changes of the curriculum and what's being taught. Now, when the National Policy Framework Development came out in 2007, it was trying to address that to say, we need to know exactly what is being offered for foundation phase, senior phase, up to senior level. And we know exactly what teachers are expecting, because now what we have currently is a disjuncture. Teachers that come out into the system do not really know. For example, you got to be taught history, geography, and you get to school, you find it's NS, it's HSS. It doesn't talk to what you're being told, because there was no particular body anyway that could determine what needs to be followed so that it can talk to what's happening in education, which was something that was not there in the country in education as a whole until 2007. So the new kind of acts that came in, for example, the OSD is trying to address that. The CPDD is trying to address it so that we can have now this gap being closed. And as SAFE, we now have, as my CEO is saying, develop this research department that will talk to this and follow this debate through on, and then we'll be able to give the minister the appropriate advice on to what needs to happen. Hence, you'll find that we have teachers that still fall under 10, 11, and 12, which is your underqualified educators, teachers who the bulk is under matrix plus 3 years, which is what was needed to happen. Now, the RHUV 14 is something that Minister Pandor came with that is being phased in until 2013. So educators need to improve themselves from that one to what we're all expecting now, to say if you want to be an educator and qualified, you have to come in with a matrix plus 4 years, which needs to have this one. But now, if you look at the different specification, with the OSD, it says you do the 3 years and the 1 year, you become an intern. So these are the new ways of trying to address exactly what you're saying, to say why is there this quite of disjuncture within the education system. So we're hoping that our role as SAFE will then become more appropriate, because we are now participating in all these particular structures to help in assisting with the minister in that.
I mean, for me, I would agree with that trend, and I do think that one of the key roles that you're going to have to start playing and occupying that space as you're now saying, but more than just doing research and saying this is what's happening and so on, I think you have the ability, because you have a legislative power to do so, you have the ability to play a more meaningful role than just reflecting what is happening, if you're with me. And that the advice should be along the lines of what is required. I don't mind that there are four different ways to become a teacher. That I don't mind at all. I think it's actually going to be beneficial to people. But what I do mind is that there's hardly ever the commonality that I talk to when I say that in the law profession, you have to have certain things to be able to say that this meets the standard of a law degree. So you could have previously we had your B Juris, you had your B Proc, and you had your LLB story. But each of them had certain components that were absolutely core. And that actually they did the same in some universities. We sat with the B Procs and the LLBs sat together in most of the lectures, and it was only on the, what we call the electives, that they would go the separate ways. So it's that core that I think is lacking. The other thing that I think is lacking, which is something that you touched on as well, is the synergy between what is required in the classroom and what is required in those courses. And that nobody seems to be speaking to, because what we do is, and I keep on using this analogy, I say the department wants welders. So what do? The university trains. Some of them are engineers. Some of them are artisans. Some of them are just people who are metallurgists. But all the department wants is for the handle to be attached to the bucket, you know? And you don't need an engineer for that. You don't necessarily need a metallurgist for that. You need somebody who can attach the handle to the bucket. So in that sense, and that's why I keep on saying the department has abdicated its responsibility, because while it's done the curriculum and so on, it fails to say to HESA or whoever it is, that this is what we need your outcomes to be. Otherwise, we don't employ these people. There are no jobs for them. So that's the other area that I think needs some keen focus and some greater attention, because there's nobody up that's going to be pulling these things together. And so from my perspective, I would hope that one of the things that you take back to council is the absolute need to start pulling all of this together. So that's the issue of the powers and functions. But you also touched, Mr. Briraj, on another big issue for me, and I'm trying to still get information. I'm hoping you can help. But do you, as a council, have a sense of, now, you know, again, when we say about teachers who are unqualified, I'm not sure what that term means anymore, but given that there's so many routes to becoming a teacher, and previously you didn't even need a matric to become a teacher. So where are we now in terms of teachers who have no teaching degree, who are actually teachers in our schools, but who have no teaching, should we say, formal learning skills beyond, let's say, matric? Would you be in a position, given that you register all of these people, would you be in a position to tell us how many teachers we do have without formal qualifications? Anybody?
I'm actually looking behind me because Mr. Muhammad from he'll be able to give us more clarity on the point.
Thanks, Chair. If I may just comment on the previous discussion that you've had as well, it's just, I think it's a bit fortunate that within the department there is a process underway at the moment of aligning the requirements for both in-service and pre-service with the new higher education qualifications framework. And therefore, space will be created for SACE to make the kind of input that you were just suggesting. On the issue of the unqualified teachers...
who's running with that process?
Well, there is a discussion with CHE. Within our section in the department, we've started the process of developing a document for discussion and input on the requirements that the HEQF makes. There is, just to refer to some other point that you were making, at the moment the department has a document called the Criteria for the Recognition of Evaluation of Qualifications, which sets out the minimum requirements for employment in education. And that's the responsibility we've played, but as you've correctly pointed out, the HEIs have not complied fully with that policy document. But we have had a discussion with the Dean's Forum, HISA Dean's Forum, about the new process. And there is an intention, as soon as we are ready with a document, to go to all the stakeholders. But just recently we've had the same discussion about the professional council playing the kind of role that other professional councils play in setting the requirements for professional standards.
I think we need a discussion on that in the portfolio committee from the department. We'd like to hear what your ideas are on this issue, and I think at some stage you need to come and present to us once you finalize your document, and certainly while you are busy with your consultations with HISA and other stakeholders and so on, because I'm just a bit worried that we, as far as the department is concerned, we tend to take a back seat to HISA and other people. And we don't, you know, if you're an employer and you're making those buckets, you should be saying to people, you stipulate to the marketplace what your needs are, not the other way around. You with me?
Yeah.
So I would be very keen to see what you guys are doing there. And perhaps at some stage, if you could liaise with Mr. Brown and just tell us that you're ready, we will make space for you in the Portfolio Committee's program to come and talk. And then, of course, if you guys are ready on some issues as well, I'd be very happy to accommodate you at any stage as well.
Just a quick point there, Chair. In terms of our stats, we have got 25,505 provisionally registered educators. Now, the only reason is they would be provisionally registered is that they are not fully qualified. So that gives you a little bit of a ballpark number of unqualified teachers in the profession. Now, it won't be that number because it could very well be a lot of them are no more teaching. We wouldn't know that. So it is in that region. Yeah, but they're not fully qualified.
May I just comment on that issue as well? There was some research done by our section last year, which is showing that there's about 145,000 teachers who are variously classified as underqualified. But the most serious issue, I want to agree with Mr. Bridge, that our research is showing is about 25 teachers who are at REQB 10, which is matric, just with matric
quality. 25.
That's the figures that we've got. If you look at, there's a section in the resource pack that we produced for the Teacher Development Summit that has got a breakdown of that detail, but we can easily send to you, you know, by the end of today,
the details. I can't remember seeing that particular one in my pack, but I do know that I didn't get the full pack. I would be most surprised. I don't know if you guys were surprised at that. Are you happy with that? With that notion that there are only 25 teachers who have matric?
No, 25,000.
Oh, 25,000. Oh, okay. No. That one kind of puts me in a place of comfort.
Yeah.
Negatively so, of course. Ms. Gina and then Mr. Khaniyaho. Okay, let's go. The code of conduct and ethics and so on. You did kind of allude to it in your presentation, but do I understand correctly that a member who's found to have violated the code of ethics is then sanctioned in some ways? Now, I'm not sure whether there are various ways to do a fine, for example, maybe one such. And I guess the ultimate sanction would be that the person would be struck off your register, which would then legally imply that the person is not able to work as a teacher anymore. Am I correct in that assumption? And have you followed through that process? In other words, are there teachers, firstly, who you've struck off the roll, number one. Number two, have you, what are your systems in place thereafter to ensure that the employer body is made aware of this? Because clearly there's a possibility and a potential for dyssynergy, and that in fact, de facto, the person is then dismissed.
Let me make one or two comments and then the other colleagues will add. Your last point
he is the one that council has kind of been alerted to, because there have been one or two teachers that have sneaked back into the profession after they've been struck off, you know, and this was a wake-up call for us as council. Now, council thought long and hard, and one of the things that they have now put in place is a database on the website, our website, for educators that have been struck off the roll. And we hope, you know, all of us spread this message that whenever there is a doubt or wherever there is a teacher to be employed, we are asking for employers not only to look at the registration certificate, but to check the standing of the teacher by getting to our website, punching in the teacher's ID and checking if they are of good standing. And then also, if that is not possible, to contact us, either physically or telephonically, where we would check. So we are putting measures in place. In fact, we want to go further, and we have just taken a decision now lately to have a whole section of our work that is following up on all of these people that have had sanctions meted out to them. Because there are other things that we ask them to do, like, for example, to go for rehabilitation, anger management. There's a lot of corrective stuff that we do. But quite honestly, we have not followed them up to be saying that, look, if indeed. And maybe that should also factor into to track that these teachers are definitely out of the profession. So thank you very much for that. The complaints
allude you to another act that we passed when I was the Chair of Justice, which was the Sexual Offences Act. Now, it's a bit different, but it may have some overlaps with regard to what you do. What we provided for in that act was that prospective employers are obliged, before engaging the services of somebody, when it comes to working with children, to get a certificate of clearance from the Registrar of Sexual Offences. Now, a similar provision is something that you could possibly think of with regard to a clearance from yourself for employment of teachers.
Thank you for that advice. It's good time because we want to engage with the Minister in terms of amendments. The question of how complaints come, it's quite interesting that SAFE will take even a rumor as a complaint, other than formal complaints that come in writing or telephonically that come to us or via counselors. So we take complaints in any form. And the other nice thing is that we will also respect the confidentiality of the complainant, because in this business you find there's a lot of threats and fear that surround all of this. So, of course, but at the end of the day, we've got to have sufficient evidence and witnesses to give someone a fair chance to defend themselves. Temba, you want to, and others, to talk about the unprofessional conduct, what is the nature of it, the dress code, how far is the debate, CD, the ECD? Yeah.
Thank you, Chair. Just to answer on the ECD part, when it comes to CPDD, unfortunately, the ECD practitioners who are not within the school system are not targeted, and this is because the national policy framework is only talking on school-based educators. So our scope of working is within that particular aspect. But the fact that we are registering ECD educators and looking at the qualification, we are working as the PD section of SAFE to ensure that we do give them some support. Because as you would know, that most of the ECD centers are not properly mandated, as we say, and it's difficult to find them as in the irregular way they're being done. But as SAFE, as the Professional Development Division, we are making sure that we do give them a capacity to go through. But when it comes to the formal part of the CPDD, unless they are part of the schooling system and they are school-based within the system, we can only then deal with them. Otherwise, if they're out of the scope of what the policy is saying currently, we are unable to do that. Though we have called for a review in the policy, but not only will it affect the ECD, it's affecting the office space, it's affecting ABED, is affecting FET, because no one else is covered within this particular system, and every educator in our training needs to be developed professionally.
Now, I think the debate on the dress code, I said when we did our presentation that that's the debate that we started, but we could report to this House today that I think the reports that we are getting from schools is that some of the schools are progressing well in this matter, that schools have already determined their own dress codes,
which has been agreed upon by the whole school community. And that's what we wanted to achieve out of this debate, actually. That schools must be able to consider what society they are serving regards as professional kind of dress by teachers, and they have taken that into consideration, and we are happy as council that that is bearing fruit. I think Esther would deal with the unprofessional conduct aspect. Eh?
Thank you. You want to know what might be in that category? It's really everything that doesn't have some other heading, but it's a lot to do with relationships. It's often as a result of a poor climate in a school, poor management, so we have conflict between management and educators in the school. The one is rude to the other, the one sidelines, the other doesn't promote the interests. It does also, to some extent, cover doing the work badly, not meeting deadlines, those minor, relatively minor breaches of competence as far as educators are concerned. It could go so far as promoting a learner who ought not to be promoted, although that could be covered in another category. So it covers a lot of things. Mostly, SAFE then goes in and tries to mediate rather than handing out sanctions to all and sundry, because in fact there's a whole climate that's wrong in that school. So SAFE will then work with the school to improve the working conditions. And we have teachers being thoroughly rude to each other, insulting each other, totally inappropriate behavior in front of learners, in front of parents. So we get a lot of those cases. As you can see, it's the greatest number. What can SAFE do as far as sanctions are concerned? You asked that question. It's a full range, including warnings, going all the way to striking off, but it includes fines. And quite often, when appropriate, imposing a sentence that requires the teacher to undergo courses that would correct behavior. We do try to correct rather than be punitive all the time, because in some cases it's, again, a lack of professionalism because of lack of training, lack of education. The teacher just didn't get it in the original qualification, and so still needs to be educated. So we're not going for the striking off except for the serious offences, sexual offences, assaults. Those ones are regarded as serious and teachers are struck off. We also have suspended striking off. Mostly that's in the case of corporal punishment of a milder nature, like a slap would get a suspended striking off, which the ethics department believes is severe because that teacher is under threat of repeating that offence and then being finally and permanently struck off. So there are a range of sentences.
On unprofessional conduct, the CEO referred to the professionalism and the code of ethics. What is the council's view on strikes? Teachers are constantly being mobilized to strike on different issues. I met a few teachers in the Northwest 2 weeks ago, and they were very against striking. And they said teachers provide essential services, and they should not be permitted to strike at all. What is the council's view on teachers striking during schooling hours? I'm not referring to in the afternoons, for instance. That is the teacher's own time.
Thank you, Chair. The Council has a very clear view on this, and we've made it public a few times. One is that Council will not interfere with something that is a labor right, where it is a protected strike, or it is an action that is within the legal labor framework, and it has been agreed to. The council stays away from that. But definitely, where teachers are on so-called illegal strikes, ma'am, you know, doing their own thing, which no sort of agreement has been reached to, or there's been no proper procedure followed, and teachers are just taking the protest action into their own hands, then definitely those teachers would be deemed
to be acting unprofessionally, and the council will consider that complaint against them.
Do you think it is at all professional for a teacher to strike at all at the expense of the learners during schooling hours? It's not acceptable. Not at all.
I don't, the council doesn't have a view on that, and it wouldn't it sort of get into discussions with that because it falls out of the professionalism kind of terrain. And we support what is in the law, whether it's in the labor law or whether it's in the negotiated in the Education Labor Relations Council, we would support. If we find that the law does not approve of striking in school time, SAFE will be fully behind the law. So whatever goes in the name of the law, SAFE will support, definitely.
Cop out, I think. Now, look, I understand that your council is made up of various members of organized labor. And so it's very difficult terrain for you to take this issue head on. But I think the point that is being made here is that you are ultimately responsible for teacher professionalism and the status in which people hold the profession as a whole, and thereby should be striding miles ahead of what is in the law and what is in the regulations and so on and so on. And it's really a bit of a problem when on a very central issue and very, very, shall I say, topical issue that you don't have that stance, I think is difficult to, and while we understand your own difficulty, it's something that I think is to be revisited now that you have a new council and a new constituted council from time to time. I think it is very much within your purview.
Thank you, Chair. I think you're right. It's a matter that we will take to council. Council is, as I said earlier in my comments, maturing beyond just being subservient to these things. So thank you. We will take that forward.
There are other ways in which teachers can certainly exercise their rights in terms of labor relations, really. And given that education is a crisis, I do think in this country where we are at this particular point in history, I do think that there's some sense in you taking that discussion forward. How far you get, of course, is something that I'm going to sit and lament about most of my days.
It'll be an employment.
After you put the matter on the agenda. Okay. You could say that it was Professor Klopper's Lawrence who raised it.
Something. I challenge you to drive the issue and we will be right behind you.
Talking for the DA, I'm not quite sure about Khanyafo. Mr. Khanyafo, you had your hand up earlier, sir.
Thank you. I think in the presentation there is on page 3, this 5,281 provisionally registered educators. Just for clarity, are these unqualified teachers and underqualified teachers? Is this the category? I want to understand how you deal with this. Is there a situation where you could register an underqualified teacher? Underqualified. He's a qualified teacher, but he's underqualified. Now, would you register such a teacher provisionally, or can that teacher get full registration? Perhaps as a confusion with underqualified and unqualified teachers. Because in my opinion, unqualified teachers to me are not yet teachers. They are unqualified. Unqualified teachers who do not meet perhaps the requirements such as maybe having a degree or something like that. The second one, coupled to that, is in connection with the FET colleges. I know the FET colleges perhaps don't fall under basic education, but you register FET college educators, because I know that is exactly where you have a lot of teachers who are unqualified. They could be having very high qualifications, but they are not teachers. I don't really mean it in a very negative sense, but what I mean is they are not qualified. They have not been trained as teachers. So what I observe is, in the past, we'll always refer to the past because the past is there. Teachers in the FET colleges were trained in some institutions, and those institutions do not exist anymore. So I don't know how you deal with this, because you will have a lot of people who are in FET colleges who are doing a good job, but they are not teachers. That's the opinion I have. So maybe this needs to be visited as well. I think these are the few issues that I have. I think, sir, that's actually the category that is provisionally registered because they don't meet the minimum requirements to get. A teacher needs to have your matric as the basis, the professional teaching qualification. That becomes then your full criteria, and the teacher should be a South African citizen, isn't it? If the teacher, like what the other colleague is saying, the teacher has a BCom degree, but not a professional qualification, and a school needs somebody to teach economics, that school has the liberty to enlist the services of that person, but for that person to practice, he needs to be registered with FAIS. And because he or she does not have a professional qualification, she cannot be given full registration as a member of FAIS. Then we give provisional registration to such people.
Qualified as a welder and wanted to teach economics in a school, what would you do there? Was a welder. In other words, would you still register provisionally because there's no value to the qualification, if you're with me. I think that's the other issue that is being raised here.
I think, sir, one thing we need to understand. We are a South African Council of Educators. So for you to be registered, you have to have a teaching qualification. That's full registration. So it's the matric plus 3 years of what you've done as a teacher with any other profession. But because our profession is dicey, take the FET, for example, where artisans were more employed and not having the education qualification. We are therefore saying, the council has made provision to say, because you don't need